formal gathering for this retreat time together. So during this retreat, we'll be having some periods of devotional chanting in the morning and the evening. And so everyone is invited or encouraged to join in with the chanting and the bowing and the ritual side of things. But it's our custom not to make things obligatory. You can't really have obligatory devotion. Doesn't really... The chemistry doesn't quite work. So if you don't feel comfortable with chanting or bowing and such like, then please feel welcome just to sit and watch and listen if you like. But of course, people are warmly invited, encouraged to join in if you do feel comfortable with that. So to begin with, we'll just do the very first part of the evening chanting. We'll do it in English, just for those who are unfamiliar with this whole business and for whom this is their first retreat and first involvement. So to make it easier, so we'll do the first little section of the evening chanting, which begins on page 9 in the chanting books. And if anybody hasn't got one with them, then there's a supply of them outside the door, I think. Is that right, Kathy?
Yeah.
So looks like everyone is equipped. So begins on page 9. So we'll just sit together quietly for about half an hour now, and I understand this is the first retreat for some people, but please, just for the time being, just use whatever meditation practice you're used to doing, as long as it doesn't involve cartwheels or handsprings or anything. Just use the kind of meditation that you're used to for this next period of time, and we'll just sit silently together, as I said, for about 30 minutes. please do stretch your legs for a minute or two if you need to. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhassa. Buddhang Dhammang Sanghang Namassami. This little piece we say at the beginning of a Dhamma talk is usually just the person who's going to be speaking that recites the Namo Tassa. So thank you for all joining in, but you didn't really need to. This is an occasion we have to be together for a few days and joining in a time of retreat like this together, then it's natural to have expectations, wishes, hopes, fears. This is ordinary for us. So many people, when we had the go around earlier this afternoon saying, I'm really looking forward to this time. This is something that is very special, or this is something that I've been looking forward to, and that's natural and ordinary for us. But when we set up expectations, then of course we create the causes for disappointment. And as soon as we want it to be this way, then we immediately create the causes for fearing that it's going to be that way. So it's important at the beginning of a retreat to be looking at that quality of attitude. What's the mindset that we're bringing to this situation, to this time together? So at the beginning of any retreat, I always encourage any of you who've been, many of you said you listen to my talks, podcasts of retreat talks and other teachings. So you'll know that over and over and over again, particularly on the beginning of a retreat, I emphasize that it's important to set the clear and conscious intention to learn from whatever happens, so that we might have a particular set of hopes and wishes and that's natural for those to arise. You know, I hope that my mind becomes concentrated and clear and peaceful. I hope that there is insight, wisdom arises. I hope that my obstructive, difficult habits fade away and disappear forever. Yeah, natural enough. Yeah, it's like writing a little list for Father Christmas. Dear Santa, what I'd like for Christmas. It's natural enough, but we can't stop those kind of thoughts arising. But we can also affect the attitude with which we view them. We can handle those different thoughts, those different ideas in different ways. If we believe in them and we buy into them and invest in them, then, as I said, we create the seeds of disappointment. Yeah. Oftentimes we start a retreat, or we're booked onto a retreat, and suddenly the experience is one of anxiety, because you can feel a cold coming on, or that suddenly there's an ache in your tooth, and you're, oh no, it's only 3 days, and I've got this toothache coming on, and am I going to have some sort of emergency dental trip? Oh no, it's exactly what I don't want. And if you are having toothache, don't think I'm reading your mind. This is this is just a random example that I'm just inventing. But if we're wise, then we set the intention at the beginning of a retreat to learn from whatever happens, so that you make a clear and conscious intention. Whatever comes up, whether I have a toothache and I need to make an emergency trip to the dentist, or whether my mind is clear and peaceful and all of my problems fall away, I set the intention to learn from that. And in some respects, having a mind that's, you know, clear and peaceful and free of obstructions is not intrinsically any better than a trip to the dentist. You know. It's how we handle it, how we work with it. A few years ago, I was leading a retreat up in Angela Center, Santa Rosa, in the autumn. It was kind of cool, foggy weather, and one of the people was actually local to this area, Dan Landry, maybe he's even here actually. Dan had a, because it was a walk through the outside, through the outside air between the hall of residence where he was staying and the meditation hall, and the cool foggy air in the early morning brought on an angina attack, and he was indeed whisked off to the hospital and needed surgery. Quite serious surgery, if I remember correctly. So, middle of the retreat, Dan goes off to spend 3 or 4 days in the hospital, has heart surgery. Two or three people from the group, his wife and a couple of others, go in, spend a couple of days at his bedside at the hospital. And then he insisted on coming back and finishing the retreat. That was it was very impressive. So hospitalized on Tuesday, back on Saturday or Friday even, and also was saying, I carried on the retreat as best I could in the hospital. That's a serious interruption to the retreat. You know, spending a certain number of hours on the operating table and in recovery. But I thought this was an extremely wise person, a very good attitude, that you don't think, oh, my retreat's been ruined, but rather, oh, well, I didn't expect this, but what does it teach me? Yeah. And that kind of readiness to learn from whatever comes up is an extraordinarily useful resource for us in our life as human beings, because as I was saying earlier today, we establish a very supportive and helpful environment like this, noble silence, the food is arranged, and there's a neat schedule, everyone's on the precepts, people are behaving very respectfully and kindly and gently towards each other, everything is harmless and scent-free, fragrance-free. But as I alluded to earlier on, the world beyond this retreat center is not fragrance-free. It's a kind of stinky world, and it's unpredictable and agitated, and it doesn't always accord with our wishes, you might have noticed. Yeah, the world impinges, and if we set up the attitude within us, I can only practice in a perfectly sterilized, quiet, serene, contained, controlled environment, then it's going to be very difficult to practice, because the world is not like that. And even if you try very, very hard to protect the environment, the very effort to protect it and contain it and keep all of the disturbances at bay can often sometimes in a mysterious way magnetize all the troubles of the world to you. Many years ago at Amravati, we didn't have a full routine of our own retreats during the year. We only had like 2 or 3 10-day retreats in the year, and we'd lend out the retreat center to other groups. And one particular group, they like to have their retreat environment very, very precisely controlled. And there was a very strict rules about what happened and who, and how things worked and the comings and goings of everyone. It was an extremely regulated retreat. And it was like some kind of invitation for all of the chaos of the universe to show up. It was quite eerie. I mean, we weren't, you were trying not to laugh about it, but it was very strange. There was this young fella who used to come around the monastery from time to time, who was very unpredictable in his behavior, and he just happened to just arrive at the as soon as this retreat had begun. Then it began on this Friday evening, and then boop, he shows up on the weekend, and then. And where does he gravitate to? He's right there walking through the women's dorm, on on this super controlled retreat. And I said, please, could you come and remove your meditator? He's disrupting the retreat. He just walked through the women's dormitory. This is not appropriate. Sorry, he's not really ours. He just showed up. Not that I'm predicting anyone, we don't send out invitations to all of the kind of the forces of disturbance in the universe, but sometimes our very effort to control seems to set up the conditions for the opposite. So if we're wise, then everything will teach us. We set up that attitude, so that even if some stranger walks into your room in the middle of the night and, sorry, is this the Seashore Hotel? No, this is a meditation retreat. Oh, sorry, I must have taken a wrong turn there. okay, this is something to learn from. Yeah, someone's taken a wrong turn and ended up in my bedroom. Okay, well, let's go and find the manager and we'll find a phone and see if we can get you sorted. We create suffering through our attitude. And even when things are extremely difficult or painful, like our friend Dan being whisked off with a serious heart trouble during a retreat, then even then, something you would never wish for and you'd decidedly like to avoid, even when the worst happens, the most difficult and testing, still it can be something that we learn from. It can be a source of great wisdom and liberation. So I strongly encourage at the beginning of a retreat time, not that I'm predicting invaders or heart disease. Hopefully by saying all of this, you'll have the most calm, unremarkable, undisturbed retreat time together. But even if there's some kind of difficulty pops up, still, if we have the attitude, oh, well, here's something I didn't expect, so what's this teaching me? What can I learn from this? Then, in this way, nothing can go wrong. Even if it's something that you never expect or you really wouldn't choose, you realize, oh, that the wrongness of it is entirely stemming from my attitude. And if we have a flexible and open attitude, then everything is our teacher. So, you know, someone sitting up here on the seat in the middle with the microphone hanging off his ear, this is officially, this makes me the teacher, but really, you are the teacher. And this is something Ajahn Chah would emphasize. So you look at me and you call me the Ajahn, but actually, if you're not listening, if you're not paying attention, then I'm not the teacher, because I'm not teaching you, you're not learning anything. And it's really the responsibility, the initiative of the individual to be listening, to be paying attention. And really, it's each of us that teaches ourselves. And he would emphasize, if we are wise, then it's not just listening to the words of the person up in the on the high seat that we're learning from, but we're learning from the sound of the frogs in the evening. We're learning from the changes of night and day. We're learning from the trees and the fallen leaves. We're learning from the people that we share the time and the space with. Everything will teach us. We will see the lessons that nature provides for us all the time. The evidence of the way the world works and things that we can learn from that are with us all the time, if we look, if we listen, if we're watching and reflecting upon our experience. So this requires or is based upon an attitude of openness, an open-hearted acceptance. And one of the other themes I like to emphasize is, which is related to this, is that when we talk about loving-kindness, when we talk about metta, or metta-bhavana, loving-kindness meditation, that's often presented as a particular kind of practice where you bring up thoughts like, you know, may all beings be happy, you know, may I be well, may I be happy, may all beings be well, may all beings be happy. But and that's quite a valid or useful approach to development of loving kindness. But I feel it's more helpful to understand or to look at loving kindness as more this attitude of radical acceptance, this very welcoming in the heart, a readiness to be with whatever is present. So that is the essence of metta, the essence of loving kindness, is that open-hearted attitude and the readiness to be with whatever shows up, whether it's pleasant or painful or neutral. And so this isn't just a metta, a loving kindness towards external characteristics of the living situation, the people that we're with, or our circumstances on the external level, but it's also and most importantly relating to our mind states. Having loving kindness, having an attitude of acceptance for our own thoughts, our difficult memories, you know, our say uncomfortable feelings in the body, or our reactions of jealousy or irritation or fear or anger that might arise within the mind. You know, even though we're living in a very benign and beautiful respectful environment, people living very carefully and abiding by a code of conduct which is very noble, encourages the best qualities in us, still we can have violent feelings towards each other. You know, that person who's, you know, you're standing, standing mindfully in the lunch queue, and then somebody, you know, mindfully walks in front of you, and takes, barges into the queue in front of you, and again, they might have their good reasons, but you might experience certain feelings arise, like, who the hell do you think you are? What's the hurry? And how dare you? Or somebody moves your cushion. Or sits on your cushion. Yeah. They move your stuff and they put their own things down on the cushion and think, that's my place. You know, you can get territorial, even though, I mean, nobody had a place before 4:30 this afternoon, and now suddenly this is my place. And somebody moves your cushion, then they can experience certain feelings. irritation or your territory has been invaded. So loving kindness, metta, is not just creating ideas of may all beings be happy, may I be happy, but that a more fundamental, almost wordless quality of acceptance. So like this is the feeling that's here in this moment. Here is this thought, this memory, this agitation or this sensation in the body. Here it is, whether I like it or I don't like it, whether it's beautiful or ugly, expected or unexpected. Here it is. This is the texture, the quality of this moment. This is how it feels. And just as when we look at any aspect of nature, you can't really walk up to a, well, you can, but it doesn't make much sense to walk up to a tree and say, you're wrong. You shouldn't be that way. Walk up to one of these redwood trees and say, you're not doing it right, you shouldn't be there. You're not doing it right. And the shape is you're just not like an oak tree, really. And you'd think, well, that's totally crazy. It's a redwood, so why should it be like an oak tree? But when you use an example like that, it's obvious. But then we can relate to our own thoughts in exactly that way. Like we have a painful memory, or we have a jealous feeling, or like, wow, his posture is much better than mine. Who does he think he is? He's showing off. He's such a good sitter. He's just doing it to shame me, because my posture is so lousy. It's just like, we can compare ourselves with others, or, we can, I'm such an idiot. I'm getting jealous about someone else's posture. I think, they're sitting straight to make me feel bad. We can say, criticize our own feelings, our own attitudes, our own thoughts. But that's as crazy as going up to a redwood and saying, you shouldn't be that way. You're the wrong shape. If it's a jealous feeling, it's a jealous feeling. That's what jealousy feels like. You're not saying it's a good thing, but you're saying it's this quality, it's this shape, it has this texture. It feels like this. This is a feeling of jealousy. If it's a feeling of enthusiasm or excitement, then it feels like this. You're not saying it's wonderful and good and perfect, but enthusiasm feels like this. So whether something is a thought or a feeling or emotion, whether it's pleasant or painful or neutral, then to have that, to cultivate, to consciously develop the attitude of loving kindness is to recognize, yes, here it is. This is the way nature is shaped in this particular moment. It's like a cloud or a leaf or a tree or a rock. It's just that shape. It's this way, and we wouldn't think of a cloud being wrong, or a tree being wrong, or a rock. Going up to a rock and saying, "You're the wrong shape." Well, if you call me wrong, that's fine. But from the rock side, it's just what it is. It's our mind that calls it wrong. So, when we relate to our thoughts and feelings, our emotions, with that quality of acceptance, then everything belongs. Our jealousy belongs, our fear belongs, our feelings of territory and selfishness, they belong just as our compassion, our kindness, our wisdom, our generosity, they also belong, and all of the neutral feelings in between. And upon that basis of acceptance, then we can discern, we can discriminate, we can say, well, if this is an angry feeling, or this is a jealous feeling, this is a territorial feeling, if this is followed, if I get angry and upset and write a sort of vicious note underlined three times in red to that person who moved my cushion, if we act upon that, it's going to be painful for us, it's going to be painful for them, everybody loses. So, this is an angry or a jealous feeling, but it doesn't need to be acted upon. We can watch it arise, we can watch it pass away. If it's a kindly and compassionate feeling, it's something that's going to conduce towards peace of mind for us or for others, then we see that if we act upon that, then it brings brightness of mind and happiness to us, and it brings happiness and peace for others. So that's something that's worthy of acting upon. So the example I always like to give is like, if you are going out to the highway and you want to go to Berkeley or San Francisco, you go north. If you want to go to Santa Cruz, you go south. It's not like south is good and north is evil. It's just if you want to go to Santa Cruz, take a left. If you want to go to San Francisco, take a right. So similarly, when we view a mind state, it's just like looking at the road. It's not like that anger is intrinsically, you know, evil and bad and wrong. It's just if you go that way, it's going to end up being painful. It's not that, you know, kindness and compassion and respect is intrinsically good and perfect. It's just if you take that turn, if you go that way, then it'll be pleasant for yourself and pleasant for others. So then there is choice, but it's choice that's being made on the basis of mindfulness and wisdom, not on clinging to good and clinging to bad, but seeing that those are, you know, say worldly distinctions that we make. And so that when we're training the mind, we're seeing that we want to focus the mind upon the breath or upon our footsteps as we do walking meditation or sitting meditation, rather than then starting a fight against our chattering thoughts and trying to wipe them out and get rid of them. Then it's more the attitude is, well, here is the chattering mind. I'm not interested in following that at the moment. I don't need to make that into the enemy. I just can look at that as something that, you know, I don't wish to attend to right now and turn the attention away from it. We don't make our thoughts, our emotions, our feelings into something that is, say, only existing in order to upset our meditation. That those thoughts did not arise just in order to ruin our retreat. They're just doing their thing. It's just the mind doing its natural thinking thing. So that in this way, when we establish a basis of loving kindness for our meditation, then you're not making your thoughts or your emotions or your physical feelings into a problem, into the enemy, into something that has to be conquered or wiped out. But rather, you're learning to work collaboratively. You're working in collaboration with the mind rather than fighting against the mind. And that very attitude of collaboration is something that's going to benefit us. Rather like teaching a young child how to write the letters of the alphabet. You know, that a little child, you know, 2 years old, 3 years old, is, you know, eager to learn how to write and to read. And so you say, okay, well, let's learn our letters. And you put a crayon in the kid's hand, and you put their hand in your hand. Say, okay, let's make an A. There's one leg, there's another leg, and there's the bar across. And then you're gently taking the kid's hand in yours, and then sort of moving it, making the shape of the letters. And then she jumps up and runs away, comes back 2 minutes later, says, I want to do a B, let's do the next one. And say, okay, we'll sit down, and okay, let's try it again. And you are gently but firmly, you're making the shapes. You're not expecting the child to have the whole thing mastered within, you know, half an hour, but you're working with that sort of bouncy, erratic, agitated energy because the kid's 3 years old. That's what three-year-olds are like. They're agitated. They're busy. They're distractible. But you patiently and gently, you know, take hold of the child's hand. Say, okay, let's try that again. Okay, one leg down here, yeah, one leg down there, bar across the middle. That's an A. An A. That's an ah sound, like A for apple. Yeah, just as has always been done for explaining the alphabet, then we patiently and carefully give direction. So that in exactly the same way we train the mind in a way that you're respecting that there's tendencies towards agitation and busyness, but you're not making that a problem, like the child's inability to write the whole alphabet. It's not a problem, it's just they haven't learned yet. Yeah, and that by giving direction in a clear and gentle way, you're making choices. You're saying, this is the first leg, that's the second leg. You're giving direction, But you're not doing that from a basis of, aggression or, relating to the child in a domineering or forceful way, like, don't do it like that, do it like this. aren't you paying attention? Yeah. As soon as you try to force the child, anyone who's ever tried to work with small children or even large children, as soon as you just try to apply will and force, you've got a fight and everybody loses. But with patience and application and kindness, then slowly the child learns. And this is exactly how it is with working with our minds. So many of you have been meditating for many, many years, so this is an old story. You've heard this many times before, but even those of us who've been doing this for decades and decades, it's still helpful to reflect and to consider, how do I try to work with my mind? How do I relate to my thoughts and my emotions? Is there really that quality of wholehearted and radical acceptance to all the aspects of my mind? Or do I pick and choose? I like this mind state, I don't like that mind state. This I approve of, this I disapprove of. Maybe the last thing I'd like to address as we enter into this time together is in a way, it's a related theme, and to do with the attitude which we enter into Dharma practice, the training of the mind, and what we're looking for in a period of time like this. One of the phrases that Ajahn Sumedho, who was the first Western student of Ajahn Chah, what he like to emphasize for many, many years, he would say that it's a big mistake to say, to look at yourself, say, I'm an imperfect person, and I've got to get rid of my problems, and I've got to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future. I'm an imperfect person who's got all kinds of difficulties, all kinds of problems. If I get rid of my problems, then I can become enlightened in the future. And you might be thinking, hang on a minute. That's what it said in every Buddhist book I've ever read. We've got difficulties or obstructions, we're unenlightened. I'm an unenlightened person who's got to do something now in order to be enlightened in the future. That's not right. But what he would point out over and over again is that when we take that particular way of thinking, then right there we've created a solid, separate individual me who's the true owner of what we call problems or difficulties. Or we say, I am a person who is unenlightened. And what he would say is that how you are at that moment creating a false image. We're establishing our practice based on self-view. We're creating the idea of a solid, separate individual me. And as soon as we create that and believe in that idea of a separate individual permanent me, then we're already off the mark. And instead, what he would emphasize is it's not a matter of doing something now in order to become enlightened in the future, but being enlightened now, being awake now. And this is a simple principle, but it makes a big difference. Because on the worldly level, the thinking mind says, well, yeah, I am an unenlightened person. I do want to become enlightened in the future. And so it can seem very reasonable. And every Buddhist book we might have read will be talking about trying to develop concentration and become wise, to get rid of our problems, our hindrances, our defilements, how to become enlightened. And it, on the worldly level, it can make sense. It can seem realistic. But what he is pointing to in that, which I feel is very useful, is to notice the effect of that, that attachment to the worldly view of things. That to start out from that sense of self-view, that I am this unenlightened person. and rather to let go of that assumption, and to say, well, there is the feelings of seeing, there's hearing, there's smelling, there's tasting, there's touching, there's the experience of thought taking shape, arising and passing away, there are emotions and memories arising and passing away. That is what we can know right now, that's what can be known within our awareness right now. And that we call it a person, we call it Ajahn Amaro giving a Dhamma talk, we call it the Insight Retreat Center, IRC. You know, that 3 years ago, this wasn't IRC, this was a closing down Alzheimer's center. You might feel it's still related to mental mental disarray in one way, shape or form. Ajahn Chah used to regularly refer to the monastery as a mental hospital. So, but what Ajahn Sumedho is pointing to is really what you can describe as learning how to practice based on right view, but based on the actuality of the experience in this moment. So out of sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, out of thought, we say retreat. We say IRC, we call it this moment, we say today is Wednesday. We create the world out of our perceptions, our thoughts, we create the conventions of our world. We say my life, my mind, who I am, this is my name. You know, we go around the circle, we give our names, our little stories. This is what I am. And so that what this is doing is say shifting the attitude to recognize, well, this is the conventional fiction of what I am. We can conventionally call this IRC. 3 years ago, this wasn't. It didn't exist. Then the group comes together, gather some money, create an idea, retreat center, some papers get signed, it get exchanged, ding, suddenly it's our place, IRC, this is us. And it has a name, and it has an ethos, and we do it like this, we don't do it like that. This is what we like to, how we like to arrange things. That's a set of convenient fictions, I would say. Just like a monastery is, or Theravada Buddhism, or our own personal stories. These are convenient fictions that we then unconsciously sort of pick up and carry around as if they were absolute realities. So when we are trying to do something now in order to become enlightened in the future, we are attaching to, the heart is buying into those conventional realities and holding them to be absolute. And so instead of that, it's most helpful to say establish our practice based on right view rather than self view. Like the right view meaning the mind awake to the reality of this moment, to see, well, we create this evening, this retreat, out of what we hear, see, smell, taste, touch, and we say retreat. we fabricate the reality of this moment. Our mind, each moment, puts together all of the elements and says, opening Dhamma talk of the retreat. He calls it this. That's like an assemblage. That's a compounded and formed condition of mind. It's a way of describing this moment, and the mind that sees, oh yeah, this is my mind's representation of this moment. It looks like this. It feels like this. This is a complex of mental formations that has this quality right now. The mind that knows, oh, this is my mind's representation of this moment. It's like this. That mind is the awake mind. That is the mind that is aware, that knows. So when the perspective is shifted from doing something now in order to become enlightened in the future to being awake now, it's like letting go of the content of experience to look at the very process of it, which is the essence of Vipassana meditation, the insight of Insight Retreat Center. The insight, the vipassana, is that, oh, this is a mental formation. I'm not saying that the entire world is a dream or is an illusion. But what we're all experiencing now, I mean, this room, this Dhamma talk, is appearing in your consciousness. I close my eyes, you disappear. I open my eyes, you reappear. Because of eye consciousness, I can see this room. I can see all of us gathered together here. I close my eyes, I can hear the crickets or the frogs. Open my eyes, the people reappear again. So when we are able to let go of our absorption, our entanglement in the content of experience, and to know that this is a process, this is the flow of perceptions coming and going and changing, there's a shift in the heart. That's that being awake now is, in essence, this is what we mean by taking refuge in the Buddha. The Buddha means the one who knows, or the one who is awake. So when we chant our praises to the Buddha, then we are certainly talking about Gautama Buddha, or the image behind us is representing Gautama Buddha, the great teacher, the founder of this religion 2,500 years ago. But as Ajahn Chah would often emphasize, the Buddha that's the refuge is not, the Buddha who lived 2,500 years ago, he's gone. He's not around anymore. That Buddha is not the real refuge. The real Buddha, which is the refuge, is the Buddho, the Buddha, which is the awake quality of your own mind, your own heart. That's the refuge, because when the heart abides in that knowing, embodies that quality of awakened awareness, then there is a fundamental security. Different things can take shape: pleasant feelings, painful feelings, beautiful objects, ugly objects, pleasant sensations, unpleasant sensations, beautiful fragrances and awful fragrances. They can appear and disappear. And if the mind is, taking refuge in that knowing, in that awakened awareness, then irrespective of what's appearing, like what appears in the mirror is not bothered by the things that appear within it, whether they're beautiful or ugly or expected or unexpected. The mirror just reflects without partiality, without bias. So similarly, when the heart abides in that quality of knowing, or vijja, awareness, when there is true vipassana, when the true insight, then there is a freedom, there is a spaciousness and a clarity, a peacefulness that is present. So just in terms of our attitude a way of looking at working with the mind and appreciating each moment, I would encourage right at the beginning of this retreat to raise this as a prospect, rather than thinking, I'm an imperfect person who's got to do something now to become enlightened in the future. Rather than me working on my problems, try to see it instead as, here is the Buddha mind looking at the way things are. Here's the Buddha seeing the Dhamma. The Buddha mind, the awake mind, looking at the way things are. And so we're not encouraging people to get inflated, walking around saying, I'm the Buddha. Which would be craziness. But to recognize that one who knows, that which is awake, that which is aware in all of our minds, when that awareness is activated, when it is embodied, when we take refuge in that, then to see how that change of attitude shifts the way we relate to our practice. So there might still be a feeling of fear, there might be a feeling of aversion, but when the heart takes refuge, when there is that true awakened awareness, then the mind recognizes, this is the feeling of fear. This is the feeling of enthusiasm. This is the feeling of tiredness. This is the feeling of irritation. This is the, it's already 8:55, when's he going to finish feeling? That's what this is. So that quality, I would encourage people just to see if you can bring that into awareness. When the mind thinks in those terms of, I've got to do something now to become enlightened in the future, catch that. Like, okay, Kocha, to see that, okay, let's challenge that. Let's see if we can reconfigure that and listen to what the guy was saying. Okay, rather than doing something now to become enlightened in the future, can I be awake to this feeling now? Can I be awake to this feeling of imperfection or a problem or incompleteness now? Can I be awake to that feeling now? What is that feeling? And seeing when that perspective is shifted, how that reconfigures our world and what effect that has upon the heart. So, or when the mind says, but I have got problems, and I am here, you know, I have got to do something about them. To say, okay, that's that, the mind creating that perspective, that attitude, can we tweak that? Can we shift that? Can it be reconfigured as, rather than me and my problems? Here is the awake mind looking at the way things are. And if the problem is that of fear or anxiety or depression or jealousy or anger, okay, here's the mind aware of an angry feeling. Here's the mind aware of a depressed feeling. Here's the mind aware of a jealous feeling. Here's the mind of a greedy feeling, of a lazy feeling. And then see if in that moment we can shift the perspective and see the difference. And what is that, the contrast between the experience of me and my problems on the one hand and the Buddha seeing the Dhamma on the other, to feel and to know the contrast between those two. So it's now 8:57, so it's definitely time to wind up my opening reflections. And so I'll finish there with the Dhamma talk for the evening, and to complete things on this opening night, we'll have the opportunity for people to determine the three refuges and the eight precepts. And so we can have a little bit more lights, Kathy, if you'd be so kind. Since, and you will find the request for the refuges and the eight precepts is, there we are, page 74 and 75. So it usually begins with, when everyone's ready, with bowing together three times, and then when you're all ready, and I would encourage those who are familiar with this to chant with a good strong voice, and those who are unfamiliar can tag along behind. So then you will help each other along the way. So do begin whenever you're ready. Atta Silani, Atta Silani. So I'll recite the Namo Tassa three times. After I finish the third time, then all of you join in and recite that together. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa.
Namo tassa bhagavato.
Buddhang saranang gacchami.
Buddhang saranang gacchami.
Dhammang saranang gacchami.
Dhammang saranang gacchami.
Sanghang saranang gacchami.
Sanghang saranang gacchami.
Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami.
Dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami.
Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami.
Dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami.
Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami.
Tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami.
Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami.
Tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami.
Ti sarana gamanang niti tang. Amabhante is your line. Okay. Okay, so then the eight precepts. Panati pata verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking the life of any living creature. Adinadana verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
Adinadana verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. Abrahmacharya verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
Abrahmacharya verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from any kind of sexual activity.
I undertake the precept to refrain from any kind of sexual activity.
Musavada verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
Musavada verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech.
I undertake the precept to refrain from false and harmful speech.
Sura miraya majapamadatana verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
Suramaraya maja pamadatana verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami.
I undertake the precept to refrain from consuming intoxicating drink and drugs which lead to carelessness. Vikala bhojana verapmani sikapadang samadhiyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from eating at inappropriate times. Okay, this next one's a long one. We'll do this in small chunks. Nacha Gita Vadita.
Nacha Gita Vadita.
Visukadasana.
Visukadasana.
Malaganda.
Malaganda.
Vilepana.
Vilepana.
Dharana.
Dharana.
Mandana,
Mandana,
Vipusanatana,
Vipusanatana,
Verapmani Sikapadang Samadhyami, I undertake the precept to refrain from entertainment, beautification, and adornment.
I undertake the precept to refrain from entertainment, beautification, and adornment.
Ucha sayana maha sayana verapmani sikapadang samadhyami. I undertake the precept to refrain from lying on a high or luxurious sleeping place.
I undertake the precept to refrain from lying on a high or luxurious sleeping place.
Imani yata sikapadani silena sugatinyanti silena boga sambara silena nebutinyanti tasama silang visotaye. Very good. So I trust you all have got settled in your various dwelling places. And sorry, this microphone's a little. My ears are not quite matched to the microphone. So we have a restful night, and that we'll gather together in the morning at 6 o'clock. So I wish you all a peaceful night. We'll close with the closing homage at the end of the evening chanting. We'll do the English version of that, and that is to be found on page 15.